Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
This is All Sides with Amy Jurevich. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Amy this week. It is the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of the past week and we preview the weeks ahead. This is our last roundtable of the year. We will look back on a busy last week in politics, of the last week of 2025, of course. We'll look back on the biggest political stories of the past year. Spoiler alert, affordability and property taxes. And we'll look ahead to what's going to happen in 2026. Spoiler alert, affordability and property taxes. But we promise in this last show of 2025 not to do a best of segment. You guys didn't bring your best of lists, I take it?
No.
Okay, good. Joining us on the Reporter Roundtable today, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Laura.
Good to be here.
Noah Blundo, executive editor for Hannah News Service. Welcome back, Noah.
Good morning.
And Susan Tebben from Ohio Capital Journal, a reporter, making her All Sides Roundtable debut. Welcome, Susan.
Happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. What took you so long? Anyway, here we are.
Been waiting.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents have been detaining people in Ohio for close to a year. But reports last week and over the weekend indicate that ICE activity and border security activity has increased sharply. Immigration advocates report an increase in detentions. Social media channels feature an increase of images and videos of what appear to be ICE arrests in the Columbus area. Police and city officials confirmed the activity, and they renewed their vow not to help federal agents conduct immigration operations. The Columbus Dispatch reports that at least one group of Spanish language bilingual schools closed Friday due to low attendance. Media and social media reports over the weekend had protesters outside a Columbus area hotel making lots of noise, blasting music, blowing their horns. Apparently, their aim was to disrupt the sleep of ICE agents who may or may not have been sleeping there. Here's a snippet of sound from a Facebook user who attended that rally.
This is amazing. There's a guy playing a trombone. This is so crazy. This is so crazy.
Columbus police did respond to noise complaints. We'll look this hour what our officials saying. Here, Representative Munira Abdulhali says she is worried about this situation.
They're terrorizing our neighbors, our friends, our family, and then calling us the problem. Hell no! They're the problem. It was black folk. It was Japanese at one point. It was Mexicans. Now it's Somalis and everyone else that looks different. Will we stand for that?
No!
Are we going to fall for that?
No!
That came at a rally in Westerville on Sunday covered by ABC 6. City officials, as I mentioned, are kind of saying we're hands off. They'll respond to legitimate calls, but they are not going to help ICE agents and border security agents. The federal government claims that these detentions, this immigration activity is designed to improve public safety. But Mayor Ginther says crime is down here in Columbus, and he points to stats that show the murder rate is the lowest it's been in several years, and the murder solve rate is up.
These statistics are important because they show our city is the safest it's been in years. And they paint a picture of trust. Trust between Columbus residents and law enforcement is the strongest it's been in some time. We are building the rapport between police and residents that we have long sought. And this questionable federal operation could erode and undermine that hard-earned trust.
Mayor Ginther speaking last week about the increased ICE activity. So now people on this panel aren't directly covering this day in and day out, but we see the social media feeds, we see the reports. Columbus so far, up until now, has really not seen the activity that, say, Chicago has seen, that LA has seen, but we're starting to see it now. Noah, what do you make of this?
Well, I have to wonder if Columbus's significant Somali population is playing a role here, given the reporting out of Minnesota, About increased activity there outside of Minneapolis. I think Columbus might be next in line in terms of the number of people from that country who were resettled after during the Civil War there. And so that was my first instinct.
It's hard to cover this, Laura, because we're all on Reddit, we're on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and there's a report, but we don't know for sure this has actually happened or if it's an ICE police activity. It could be a SWAT activity, it could be any kind of other activity, and we're not even sure it happened in Columbus unless there's a landmark.
Yeah, I mean, when there was on TikTok reports that a bunch of them were staying at a hotel by the airport, I didn't know if it was AI. I didn't know if it was just, you know, because they don't wear traditional police clothing. And so I didn't know, well, maybe there's like a convention in town. Like, we don't know. Yeah. And so, you know, and you don't know. And then, I mean, you could show up to the airport or you could show up to the airport hotel, but it's not like you're going to find them in their rooms. You know, the hotel's big. And we assume because there was a lot of noise that people targeted and believe that there's ICE there, but I haven't checked it out myself, and we just don't know.
Yeah. But advocates say, Susan, and city officials confirmed that at least there is an increase in activity here over the past week or so in Columbus.
Yeah, and social media that I was seeing, we've seen, you know, Spanish-speaking grocery stores and places like that saying, we're going to offer home delivery so that we can, you know, reduce the risk that you might be caught up by ICE and those kinds of things. So, you know, you have many different populations in this city and in this state that are looking at this and wondering, you know, what do I need to do to protect myself? And even just regular people who are legal citizens, am I at risk? So it's really hard to tell, you know, from one day to the next who they're going to target, you know, whether they're going to be targeting people that are, you know, have major crimes against them. We've seen a lot of reports where there's been people arrested by ICE that have minor crimes or maybe no crimes at all. So it's very hard to tell at this point what we're looking at.
Yeah, we've seen analysis by the New York Times and other organizations that show that the vast majority of the detainees have committed no other crime other than being here without documentation or being here illegally, even though that was the original promise by President Trump, is to just target the worst of the worst. But right, Noah, sometimes people are getting swept up who are naturalized citizens, detained for a certain amount of time. Also, folks who are here legally seeking asylum, so they're here legally. They're not completely undocumented.
Yeah, and the Trump administration's approach to, you know, asylum and refugee programs is a lot different than his predecessor. You know, ICE always has a list of, you know, mugshots to provide when they they themselves have confirmed increased activity. I think I saw in the ABC6 story they said that they launched something called Operation Buckeye.
That's right, they gave it a name.
So yeah,
they always give it everything. What was it in Chicago? It was some kind of strange name there.
Some strange name, yeah.
Midway or something, I don't know. Anyway.
But this one was Operation Buckeye, which is pretty standard for an Ohio-based operation.
Yeah, OH. Yeah. Now, 53% in the Emerson College poll released about a week and a half ago, showed that 53% of Ohioans support, quote, mass deportation. And I saw that number, when I hear the word mass deportation, it seems like, trains, busloads of folks getting deported. And I was surprised that it was that high, although it's apparently down a bit from previous polls.
Maybe they think that this is somehow going to make cities safer, although when, you know, the labor market is a supply and demand market, and when prices go up even more because they're going to have to pay more for labor because the workers are all gone, maybe people will feel differently. I don't know if people connect all this, though.
And I think there's a lot of nuance to asking people whether they want to deport. You know, I'm sure there are Americans who want to deport people who are here illegally, who are doing things that are not legal, you know, whatever. They want people to go by the book in terms of getting here. But I don't think people are saying, because they're immigrants, we want them to go. We just want everybody to be able to have their chance and be able to live in the country. And certainly not to the degree that we've seen, you know, ICE going after anyone and anything. But to have real reasons to be going through this and to be able to trust the justice system to be able to filter out who needs to be looked at and who doesn't.
It'll be interesting to see, you know, a few months from now, if this activity continues at the high profile it is, and more people sexually see it on their social media feeds, real stuff on the social media feeds, perhaps have a neighbor, perhaps a business person they meet every day, they're deported or a family member is deported, what that number goes. Because we've been sort of, it's all been sort of in the abstract here. No, there have been detentions here, no doubt about it, but they've been at the courthouse. They've been at places like that.
I think, you know, the governor talked to a lot of us reporters last week and said something to the effect of the need to have a rational discussion. I mean, we haven't had a major overhaul of the immigration laws in this country for a long time. And so we get different enforcement priorities from the executive as one president comes in and one goes out. But just because of the nature of this issue, we haven't had a comprehensive look at, you know, what is border security in tandem with, what is the refugee policy in tandem with, are we going to import highly skilled tech workers in tandem with, what are we going to do with foreign college students? Do we want to make it easier for them to stay here, harder for them to stay here? So it's a big issue, and, you know, whatever people's opinions are about what the policy should be, you know, federal lawmakers haven't come to an agreement on anything comprehensive in a long time.
And it's amazing that they haven't, because it seems like Mickey Cantor, the former House Minority Leader, lost his seat because he wanted to reach a compromise on immigration reform. That was, 15 years ago? And that was the thing that scared everybody away from this issue. And now it seems like Republicans right now are using the issue, and Democrats have used it in the past. It's almost like they don't want a solution because it's a great way to rally your voters and paint the other ones a different way.
Right, to other people. And then a lot of Republicans represent agricultural areas that have a lot of, you know, Latino and other immigrant workers. And so they want to talk tough, but they don't really want to deport. So I think there's kind of a both sidesism going on.
I think there's a lot of, with a lot of issues that we're talking about, there's unintended consequences that are just being missed in this situation. Like you say, Laura, the workers that you're looking at, you know, if those disappear, then people are going to say, what are we going to do with agriculture? What are we going to do with food service, with retail service, all this stuff? And then they're like, wait, no, we didn't mean for these people, because they're working and doing things for us. So it's very hard I don't quite understand how we're not seeing all sides of the issue to be able to say, well, this is the best way to do this. And this is not the best way to do this.
Yeah, I've always said that if you want to get to immigration reform, go after the employers, particularly large employers, who hire undocumented immigrants and penalize them. I will bet if enough of those companies start to get fined or lose their employees, that they will put pressure on Congress to find some way to get a visiting worker permit system or a path to citizenship, call it amnesty if you want.
The General Assembly just passed and the governor just signed legislation to require the use of federal E-Verify in construction industry projects to get at that point exactly, you know, make that a checkpoint.
That could force. But there is I think it's in January, we had the story on our air this morning. The temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants in the Springfield area expires, I believe, in early January. That's coming. We don't know what that means. It's not like a drop-dead date. They all would have to leave. It's a kind of a rolling application process. But that has gotten a lot of attention, of course, because of the false statements made during the campaign. In 24, Mike DeWine has been very vocal in standing up for that community. What do we know is going to happen there? Do we know what's going to happen there?
Well, he said, you know, he's talked about how he's talked to the employers there who have generally spoken positively about the Haitian asylee workers, saying basically they show up, they pass a drug test, you know, they're productive. But when their protected status expires, they will no longer be in the country legally, and many of the employers will just say, we cannot hire you because whatever that form is that you have to sign that says I'm legally allowed to work here from the IRS, they won't be able to truthfully sign that. And so that'll be the end of that. And then who fills those jobs is a question for that time, I guess.
Yeah. Has Governor DeWine spoken about that in recent? I know he was very vocal during the dogs and the cat thing that was during the campaign. And is there anything the state can do?
I don't think so. Yeah. I think this has to come from either the judicial or the the federal. And so far, I think most of the Haitians are looking at contingency plans. Some are applying to go to Canada. Port-au-Prince itself is not super safe, but there's other parts of Haiti that appear to be better. So I think they're just kind of looking at their options. It's unfortunate for them.
Yeah. Well, we'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about the next big word. Immigration was the big word in 24 and a lot of 25, but also affordability has become the big word here in Ohio. That's utility rates and property taxes. We'll talk about that when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
COSI CEO Dr. Frederick Bertley wears many hats as an educator, scientist, immunologist, and more. Add to those titles, CEO of the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. Dr. B talks about his new role and his vision for the museum. And then hear from Ohio State professor Angus Fletcher about his new book, Primal Intelligence, You Are Smarter Than You Know. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Amy Jurevich from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News.
This is the Reporters Roundtable on All Sides with Amy Jurevich. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Amy today, our reporters. Susan Tebben from Ohio Capital Journal, Noah Blundo from Hannah News Service, and Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com. 2025 was the year that Ohio lawmakers were under pressure, and they promised to do something about property taxes. Of course, property tax bills have risen sharply over the past few years, thanks largely to rapidly increasing property values. So folks on fixed incomes in particular who've paid off their mortgage were suddenly seeing their property tax bills go way up every year, and lawmakers were hearing about it. So they have spent months going back and forth over a series of property tax bills, and on Friday, Governor DeWine signed a bill that would, in theory, reduce $3 billion from the property tax expenses that Ohio pay every year. And Mike DeWine had this to say on Friday at the bill signing.
With the signing of these bills, no longer will families see dramatic spikes in their real estate taxes. And except when new levies are passed, families will experience increases in property taxes that will be limited, to the cost of living increase.
To summarize, this is, property taxes are very complicated. If you've ever looked at your property tax bill, you know how complicated it is, all the different agencies. But basically, this the series of bills would tie increases in many school property taxes to the rate of inflation rather than rising property values. Another would give the sort of obscure county board a chance to pull back a property tax increase if they determine it's not needed. Good luck with that. They also voted to increase the discount that homeowners get on property taxes if they live in the house, and they estimate all of this would save about $3 billion a year. So the big question, with this ballot issue looming, possibly in 2026, that would abolish property taxes, very questionable that makes the ballot or not, is this enough, Noah?
Well,
will it lower my property taxes? That's what everyone out there wants
to know. Here's what. If you live in a school district that is on the 20 mil floor, which is sort of the minimum amount of property taxes that a school district can levy in order to participate in the state funding of schools system, in the second half bill that you get in the middle of next year, there should be a credit applied. So they put in this inflation cap, right, that says your certain elements of your property tax cannot go up faster than inflation. If you vote for a new levy, it will go up for however much, go up by however much it is. But these unvoted increases are going to be capped in inflation. And if you live in a 20 mil floor school district, that this bill that the governor signed, it will give you a credit for to make it so as if that cap were in place 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. So kind of retroactively go back and apply the cap as if it had been in place. And so,
you won't get a check, you'll pay less.
In that situation, you may what's complicated here, and the county treasurers came in and talked about this, is some people pay their property taxes for the year in January. Well, you might get a refund check or a credit towards your next year. Also, if you buy a house, there's that prorating of who pays what share of the property taxes. That's going to get – so, you know, you're generally not going to get a check. But those people are going to see the biggest difference right away. Other people – it's going to be more about what you don't see, which is you don't see these big spikes when your house is revalued for tax purposes.
Yeah, if you're those are school taxes.
Yeah, well, there's also a cap on what on inside millage, which is property unvoted property taxes that is shared among a lot of jurisdictions, and you know, could be the library, could be the county, could be the township. Those are also capped.
You know, we have a swear jar sometimes, so we should have a millage jar here. Yeah. Every time you say the word mills or millage, and it just like eyes start to glaze.
So there is a bill that would get rid of that terminology and just go to percentages. And the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee told me that it's on his radar.
All
for
in
next
favor,
year.
Say aye. Because you know, that is there are 1,300 townships in the state of Ohio that all collect property taxes for fire departments, police departments, whatever. There are 600 odd school districts. Susan, this is a very complicated issue, and a series of bills signed by the governor on the Friday before Christmas is not going to solve it.
That's what I was going to say. It's that old Facebook thing where you put your status as complicated. That's property taxes as a whole. It is complicated because then you have to think about, you know, I have had people, friends of mine, that texted me and said, well, is this going to help? What am I going to do? And I said, well, it's complicated. But also, you know, if they're saying you're reducing your property taxes, but you also have to think about the school districts that still need money because they've had their funding reduced on the state level. And then you've had, you know, libraries that are looking at lower state contributions based on comparisons from year to year. So they'll be looking, and even especially your smaller ones, your rural ones, the ones that really, really do make a difference in their communities, looking at levies, looking at how are we going to fund our services because the community needs these things. Yes, property taxes may be lower, property, you might get some refunds, but you also have people that need these taxes and this revenue to be able to do it, and they have to get the money somewhere else, so you may see a rise somewhere else.
In general, I would say all the bills that have passed so far having to do with property tax reform have been on the margins. The real fundamental, there are bills out there and there are ideas floating that haven't become bills yet that would really substantially overhaul taxes, property taxes. And one bill that would completely get away with them and do away with them and replace them with a sales tax, those bills haven't, you know, passed. And so, yeah, I think people are going to see relief, but the real, like, substantial relief, that's all still being debated. And who knows if any of that will pass out. You know, I think the legislature is a little bit out of the gun because of this ballot initiative that they're gathering signatures for. But, or I guess it was a constitutional amendment, but yeah.
I think as to the ballot issue, well, there's two questions. First, will they get the signatures? I mean, everybody hates taxes, right? So you'd think that it's not complicated, not difficult, but you're talking about more than 400,000 signatures. And it's not just, you can't just camp out in the major population centers and get your signatures. You need 10% signatures equal to 10% of the vote cast for governor in the last election. That's where the 400,000. But you need signatures equal to at least 5% of the vote cast in half of the Ohio counties. So, you know, that means you need 20,000 signatures in Franklin County. You might need, you know, 400 signatures in Brown County or something like that.
And you always basically have to get double the required signatures because you're going to get signatures that you can't read the handwriting. They may have signed twice. They may not be actual registered voters. So there's a lot of error in these things.
And the second issue is we haven't really seen the campaign against this because, as Susan mentioned, you know, all this property, none of this property tax money goes to the state government. It goes to schools. It goes to libraries. It goes to the township fire department. It goes to whatever. So, you know, imagine you're, you know, oh, you know, this campaign wants to close your child's school. This campaign wants to defund the police, whatever like that. I mean, if the campaign comes around, those are the messages you will hear.
Susan, that's a big if, because from what I understand, the campaign that wants to put this amendment on the ballot that would abolish property taxes in the state of Ohio, it's volunteer. they're not hiring signature collectors, which you really need to do in this state to get on the ballot, especially an amendment.
Yeah, and I know that the governor has already said that this initiative looks to be untenable and makes no sense. So you already can sort of see the foreshadowing of what the counter campaign would be for that. But yeah, I mean, building a campaign and ballot initiative is a very difficult thing and a very time-consuming thing. We saw that with the constitutional amendment for abortion rights and, you know, all the other ones that were combined during that year. So yeah, it's something where you need a lot of people that have a lot of commitment and are willing to do things, you know, maybe during the day, maybe late at night, and things that, you know, envelopes, filling envelopes, calling people, all that stuff. And so yeah, it's a very big commitment, and it's a lot of work that probably would need more than volunteers, but we've got a lot of strong volunteers in the state of Ohio that really want to see change. So
it is interesting, if you look at some of their campaign, like their videos, they're pretty slick, and so I think it'll be interesting to see if they are actually being backed financially by any national group.
That was my question. Is there a national group supporting this out?
Nobody's
there.
Coming forward. But both Republicans and Democrats in the legislature are against this, and so I think whoever might be funding it, they're gonna try hard to stay in the shadows.
I mean, the thinking is, you put a thing on the ballot, you want to eliminate taxes, it passes easily. But was South Dakota had one of these recently, and it went down pretty sharply. It was 60-40. Not abolish the property tax. It's one of the Dakotas. I always get it confused which one it was.
But. It was an upper plains west state. Yeah, I don't remember. But yes, one state did recently reject this. But then it's the question. It's like $23 billion of property taxes are collected. So what's the alternative?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to put governor's candidates, it's going to put all state candidates sort of on the spot. Mm-hmm. Do you support abolishing property taxes? Do you support cutting taxes? And they're going to have to say yes or no. And you can say, I don't support this, but here's my nuanced, millage-filled answer as to why I'm not going to vote yes for this. So next steps in this fight, is there a cooling off period? Are lawmakers going to wait to see if this makes the ballot? See if this has a legitimate shot, because if it makes the ballot, I assume we're going to see much more activity at the State House.
I know there will be a lot of committee work going on with these other bills. You know, in terms of bills that, you know, will make a difference for a lot of people right away that they would see, you know, there's always talk about increasing the homestead exemption, mm-hmm. either generally for everyone or for, you know, service disabled veterans and police officers or surviving spouses thereof or something. So those ideas will be debated. There's also this, you know, things like let's convert from millages to percentages to make it more transparent. Mm-hmm. I know that there will be a lot of activity and probably some more bills passed, but whether any of them, you know, can, you know, really affect the sticker shock is a question.
Is that incentive bill? It's a bill that would give, I think, communities up to $2.5 million. If they merge. So a township merges with a larger city, or a couple of townships merge to combine resources, and in theory require less property taxes, which would lower property tax bills. $2.5 million doesn't seem like a whole lot of money to get a couple of townships to merge with, say, Hilliard or Dublin or something like that. But it's a step in that direction, though, to reduce government.
Shared services, mergers, none of this is a new discussion. We have several dozen educational service centers in Ohio. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to do as much back office work as they can, and they're supposed to, you know, farm out school psychologists so that if your district doesn't have a big enough student population to justify a full-time school psychologist, you can share it with the next school district. So there is a lot of service sharing that goes on. Mm-hmm. Whether there can be more done, you know, is, I mean, everybody's more for more efficient government, obviously.
You know what could help with this whole debate is intoxicating hemp. Sure. But apparently we're having less of it here in the state of Ohio. The governor signed bills on Friday banning all intoxicating hemp. He vetoed a provision that would have allowed the sale of popular THC-infused drinks. The law takes effect in mid-March. So what does that mean for folks who like this stuff? Are they not going to be able to get it?
You're going to have to go to a marijuana dispensary, which means you're going to have to be at least 21 years old. and it might be more expensive.
So they, basically, at the gas station down the road, you're not going to see those. They had those pictures of, like, they look like Skittles.
Nerds, but
they were
things, yeah.
They were hemp products. That makes sense to change those.
Yes. The federal law is going to allow the drinks to be sold at the gas stations, health food stores, et cetera, until November 2026. But Governor DeWine said, no, we're just going to make those illegal, like, once this bill goes into effect in March.
Is there any chance that, where does the legislature stand on this? Any chance they override this veto? These drinks are pretty popular.
The House had a really difficult time coming to an agreement on this marijuana hemp bill. I think it was something like 52, 53 votes, which is several votes shy of the override threshold. They had lots of different factions. They had, you know, the Speaker of the House himself is sort of like a prohibitionist. He's like, throw this stuff all out. I don't like any of it. But he has to manage 60-some Republicans and then see what he can get out of the Democrats, too. And there were so many overlapping factions. It was just really difficult to them to agree on anything.
Yeah. And the Senate, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Senate, they sort of wanted to more follow along with what voters had wanted in the original ballot initiative versus the House, who was trying to make all these changes and make it, you know, as you say, lean toward more toward the prohibitionists in the factions. But the Senate was more looking toward, you know, the voters wanted this certain thing. How do we square these two situations?
Yeah, because the voters clearly said, I think it was 55-45, they want legal marijuana in the state of Ohio with some restrictions, obviously age and, you know, types of things, where you can buy it and things like that. But the voter-approved law didn't get into hemp, and that was the problem.
Hemp is an unintended consequence of the 2018 Farm Bill, you know, which legalized it as an agricultural product, but I think it had these, you know, kind of trace amounts of the chemical compounds that you find in marijuana, and people figured out that you can just refine the heck out of it and make, you know, marijuana light or marijuana turbo or something, depending, and you can put it in, you know, fancy packaging. And so it kind of grew out of that, and people have been trying to close the barn door on those horses ever since.
This is big business. A lot of companies make a lot of money on this.
Yeah, there was a lot of lobbying at the legislature, including by several Ohio companies that are registered with the Ohio Department of Agriculture. So they weren't, you know, making products that, like, appeal to children, like, which is the allegation for a lot of these. They were doing more kind of like legit products, and they'll have to try to get their stuff in dispensaries. And it's going to be really hard to compete with the marijuana industry and get into the dispensaries.
And the federal law change came about at the last minute and really pulled the rug out on. I mean, the House had a proposal that was going to set up a system of hemp dispensaries. Mm-hmm. It was going to be this parallel business regulatory structure. But then the feds came in and said, actually, all of this stuff is illegal in 1 year from now. And so that really changed the tone of the debate.
Well, then President Trump last week ordered marijuana be rescheduled under federal law. So he's catching up to Ohio because we've already done this, right?
So. And I read in his executive order, I was really surprised, 40 states, 40, have medical marijuana. I was surprised it was that high. There's only 10 that do not. So I think this is kind of, for a president who can be a populist, I think this was kind of a no-brainer. And this has been discussed for decades now. Taking it down. And it doesn't legalize it or decriminalize it. It just allows it for research.
Yeah, that's what I found was interesting. A lot of it is so we can research to find whether there's risks or whether there's, so you can see where maybe we're doing this in order to create some studies that say this stuff is not really good for you, so we can do more regulations with it. Or, you know, maybe it's the other way around and he's trying to appeal to a base as other things are coming out about him now, that maybe aren't.
Do we know? I mean, because other states have had legal marijuana for more than a decade.
Right. And, you know, places like, I think, Israel have had it, and Netherlands. I think there is some kind of longitudinal studies showing that if you struggle with anorexia or have an illness that results in you not wanting to eat, such as cancer, cannabis does stimulate the appetite. But then there's other kind of wacky claims that people will make about, I've heard people say marijuana cures cancer. There is no longitudinal research showing that, you know? So that kind of stuff will be easy to disprove, I think, once they can start researching.
So does this, once these hemp bills are done, is this debate over now? The marijuana law is set. The voters approved it. We're not going to mess with it anymore. Hemp bills, if they don't get vetoed, they're going to be there, overridden, I guess?
There was some indication that people are thinking about a referendum effort. I think I saw maybe in Signal
to pull it,
report
pull
it. Yeah,
to pull back the legalization of marijuana?
No, to pull back the bill that the governor just signed.
I see, the hemp side.
Because it does change some of the marijuana laws. It changes some of the possession laws. And the other thing that the governor vetoed in the marijuana bill was something about who's qualified to work in the industry. He said it would basically make certain people who are working there now no longer able to work there because of things about, you know, which parts of your criminal background can or can't be considered in licensing you to work in a dispensary or cultivator.
So it's not over. The debate's not over.
No. I mean, it's been going on long enough. I think it'll continue. I mean, I remember years ago when I used to work down in Southeast Ohio, Meigs County Gold is a very famous strain of marijuana. I know intoxicating hemp, marijuana, very complicated. They were saying, yes, if we can get this to be legalized and we can be able to do something with this to make commerce, then that can help us with the economy that is withering down in this part of the state, and be able to help create businesses, be able to create jobs, be able to do these sorts of things. So it's sort of like, are we going to help with the economy part of it, or are we going to sort of legislate this to death to be able to not say anything?
I also wonder if they're going to tinker with the taxes, continue. It's 10% at the register is the special excise tax for cannabis, and I'm just wondering. They've already changed it in Senate Bill 56 that Governor DeWine just signed, and I'm wondering if they're going to continue to kind of tinker with that.
Governor's... I don't know if he's say that he's enthusiastic about it. He has turned to sin taxes as a proposal to fund various of his priorities. He's successfully once and unsuccessfully again tried to raise the sports gambling tax, for example. So I wouldn't be surprised to see something like
that. I'd like to see legislation to change the name of sin taxes to something else.
Pagovian taxes, I think, is the economic term.
Pagovian, oh man. Put that next to millage. When we come back, we'll look back on the start of the 2026 campaign, its midterm year, is about a week away. Well, that's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
This is All Sides with Amy Jurvich on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Amy today. It is our weekly Reporters Roundtable, our last Reporters Roundtable of 2025. Joining me is Noah Blundo, Executive Editor for Hannah News Service. Also Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com. She's a politics and policy reporter there. And also Ohio Capital Journal reporter Susan Tebben. We're talking about the last week, the last flurry of activity at the State House, and where we go from here as the calendar turns. This is the end of 2025, which means we are almost officially in a midterm election year in 2026. The candidates for governor in the major parties seem to be set. Vivek Ramaswamy, the businessman on the Republican side, Amy Acton, the former health director on the Democratic side. They've been very busy wooing, to use that term, which I do not like, trying to win the support of party insiders, going to smaller gatherings, and we're going to see those campaigns really intensify over the next few months. On Friday, not a huge surprise, Amy Acton picked up the endorsement of former Senator Sherrod Brown. Now, I have to say, we were talking about how some people had not endorsed candidates yet on my TV show last week, and we were saying, Sherrod Brown, he's going to wait till after the holidays and make a big splash by endorsing Amy Acton. So what does he do at 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock on a Friday before Christmas? He announces he's endorsing Amy Acton. Was he hoping no one would notice?
It's really strange because she actually has quite a few brown people working for her.
His wife had endorsed her weeks ago.
Right.
I mean, it's not a huge deal. He was he was obviously going to endorse her, but
perhaps that's what he thought was, people are not going to be surprised by this, so let's just throw this out there. I have bigger fish to fry.
I got Christmas shopping to do. I got to buy the rose for Christmas. Let's get the acted endorsement off my list.
It's a bit of a formality, I guess.
The question is, on the Republican side, Vivek Ramaswamy, a lot of Republicans have endorsed him. John Husted, many other Republicans, Bernie Marino, have endorsed Donald Trump, of course, being the biggest to endorse Vivek Ramaswamy for governor. Mike DeWine has not endorsed him yet. Now, the filing deadline is still a few weeks away, so technically somebody else could get in the race. But he was asked about it last week, several interviews. He says he's still talking to the Ramaswamy folks. Is there anything else there? I mean, he wanted Jim Tressel to run for governor, I think. I think it's pretty fair to say.
He said that he is going to support the Republican nominee. So I don't think that there's any real indication that he's not going to eventually come out and back Vivek Ramaswamy. But he wants to, he says he wants to understand his positions more, maybe convince him of some things. He's in his last year of office. He's trying to have what influence he can. And,
he also said at that same event, Ramaswamy's main line of attack against Dr. Amy Acton is that she closed down schools and other things during the pandemic. And Governor DeWine was very clear, like, whoa, I just want to say that buck stops with me. Those were ultimately my decisions. She could suggest whatever she wanted, but I made the ultimate decisions. I thought that was really interesting that he said that.
And he said that at the time, too. I mean, I know she writes the orders as the director of public health for the state of Ohio. If it's a health order, that person has to sign it. But she worked for Governor DeWine. Yeah. She wasn't going to go rogue.
Right. Yeah.
It was interesting. I was at the same event, and to hear him say, well, I heard, I got advice from many people, and I the buck does stop with me, but I did get advice, which sort of seemed, from remembering the COVID days, he was very complimentary of Amy Acton and very, willing to give her due. Whereas, now that we're looking at, a gubernatorial race, maybe he was dancing around it a little bit more. I mean, that could be speculation on my part, but just to look at, how he sort of just said, yes, Amy Acton was a part of something that at the end of the day ended with me.
Yeah.
Governor DeWine's legacy, I think, will be being a very conservative Republican, but also giving a ton of money to children. And not just, the wraparound services in schools, but also a lot of groups of kids that are forgotten about. I mean, he did a lot with foster care. Mm-hmm. And I think he is just waiting to see, if Vivek Ramaswamy does support any of this, if he's going to undo any of it, that kind of thing. I think that's probably one of his big concerns before coming out for him.
Amy Acton and Mike DeWine worked together very closely during those, especially those very first days of COVID, which were, we forget how uncertain those times were. Mm. And we didn't know at the time what we didn't know. So, yeah, there were decisions that were made that probably in hindsight weren't the best, but at the time, we were washing our canned goods with, bleach. Mm-hmm. We had no idea. There's no chance Mike DeWine's going to endorse Amy Acton, but he's not going to call her Lockdown Amy when he's out campaigning for Vivek Ramaswamy.
Well, that's a question of whether he'll be out campaigning for Vivek Ramaswamy. I mean, he'll very likely endorse the Republican nominee, as he said. And then there's also the question of, Governor Mike DeWine is generally popular. I think he polls pretty well, but he's not in
the Emerson poll. His approval rating is at 26% right now.
Oh, interesting.
26% now. 26% approve him. 26% disapprove him. Mm. And most people are in the middle. They well, whatever. He's going. Yeah. He's our governor. He's leaving in a year. I think that's probably what it is.
Yeah. There's also the question. Yeah, who's paying attention? But his broad popularity among the populace and then his popularity among Republican primary voters and, the kind of Trump Ramaswamy ring of the Republican Party, which is a little different than his style, is another thing. Mm-hmm. So, I would not expect Mike DeWine to be a central character in October of 2026 on the campaign trail.
I think you're right there. Now, Amy Acton, on the other hand, that poll and other polls have shown people aren't quite sure what to make of her. They know who she is from her COVID days, but they don't know her as a possible governor. They know her as health director. They know her as a doctor. But what is she going to do with education? What is she going to do with property taxes? What is she going to do with workforce? Mm-hmm. I really am curious to see what kind of politician she becomes, or she shows herself in the next 6 months.
Yeah. I mean, she's definitely been taking the tour. She's been in Southeast Ohio. She's been all over trying to sort of create what I've seen as sort of an everyman, every woman, I suppose, sort of person that is someone who's down to earth, sort of a foil to Vivek's entrepreneur, sort of a elite kind of person. And I think that's what she's said in her campaign statements and things of, you know, she wants public education support. She wants all these things. And on top of that, you know, science-based medicine and things like that. So I think she's just trying to make herself a relatable candidate in comparison to Vivek.
Mm-hmm. To win, she has to say we need change from what's happening now. And what's happening now is being run by her former boss, Mike DeWine. Mm-hmm. And even when she was on this show a while ago, she was reluctant to criticize him, even about his decision to send National Guard troops to D.C., which is that's low-hanging fruit for a Democratic candidate. Does she go hard after Mike DeWine and what he's done? I can't see that.
I think she goes after the legislature. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the easy one for her. And also, policy-wise, I mean, she and the legislature are pretty far apart because the legislature is more conservative and ideological, I think, than Governor DeWine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and while she, you know, she resigned as health director when she got to the point where she didn't feel like she could, you know, or she didn't agree with the actions that were being taken, the stronger foil to her was the legislature. They were the ones who came in after the fact and said, all this stuff that Governor DeWine and Director Acton did, no more. Can't have these broad, lasting emergency orders, you know, in effect for long periods. They have to be renewed. They can be overridden. So, yeah.
Vivek Ramaswamy is a force. He is very good on social media, very good on TikTok and Instagram videos. Sometimes he gets out a little bit over his skis when he said we should abolish property taxes, and then he wants year-round school, and he had to pull it back a little bit. What do we expect from him in the next 6 months as this campaign really starts to ramp up?
Probably more of like making big promises, but not really showing the details of how this is going to be accomplished. Like, for instance, he keeps talking about merit-based pay with teachers. Well, in order to do that, you're going to have to change major parts of collective bargaining agreements, possibly get rid of school, like teacher unions altogether. He won't go there. You know what I mean? He won't show us the details. So he'll probably just continue doing more of that.
I mean, Kasich ran 15, 20, however many years ago it was, on let's get rid of the income tax. And people are like, how are you going to do that, John? You know, where are you going to get the money? Whatever. But most change happens incrementally. And over the last 15 years, the legislature has slowly winnowed down the income tax. I should say, I might have said a different tax of this. Income tax. And Ramaswamy may well be in a position to be the governor who presides over the elimination of the Ohio income tax.
Hopefully.
But it might take in the entirety of an 8-year term if he is elected and reelected.
Susan, if affordability is the word of the campaign, which it appears to be or will be, who better carries that? Is it a billionaire, Vivek Ramaswamy, or is it, I mean, Amy Acton's a physician. She's not exactly, you know, she has a sort of a hardscrabble upbringing, foster care from Youngstown area, difficult childhood. Who brings that home to Ohio voters better, do you think?
Well, that depends on who you ask, Mike. Mm-hmm. I, as a reporter, can't say for sure. Yeah. But, you know, you have both arguments, and we've seen these arguments before, of the age-old, I am not a politician from Amy Acton. I am a person who has had a life in Ohio and done any number of things to get by and had to deal with grocery prices, had to deal with health care, all that stuff. And then you have a businessman, an entrepreneur on the other side that says, I can, from the other side of things, make things better via the legislature, via, you know, making the economic choices that we need to be able to reduce these things. And so, you know, it depends on which side of things you believe and which side of things you are, that one or the other would make sense.
We have about 2 minutes left, and we're now just going to talk about the Senate race, because we know both of these guys for the most part. At least we do. I'm not sure voters are as familiar with John Houston as insiders are based on, again, polling. We know who Sherrod Brown is. He's been in office for a long, long time. That campaign is going to be more intense, perhaps, than the governor's campaign because of the national implications.
Well, definitely, yes. Probably much more pricey, too.
Yeah.
And Sherrod Brown, I think, like early signs show that he's not really having trouble raising money, even though he's not an incumbent, because he has people and relationships that go back decades.
Yeah,
it's clear that Husted is going to have to answer for the Affordable Care Act votes and things like that to see how that's going to poll. And Sherrod, I'm sure, has already gone after that. So
yeah, John Husted supported a 2-year extension of the subsidies with some other restrictions on income and things like that, minimum payments. Same with Bernie Moreno. That's hard to explain when you voted against, you know, a 3-year mm-hmm. extension. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Sherrod Brown was one of the early Democrats to hit on the affordability issue. You're seeing pretty much everybody in the party now talking about that, but Sherrod Brown was first.
But he's 70-some-odd years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a real thirst for among Democrats. It's not going to happen in the primary, but voters in general for a new generation of leadership. And that's going to – John Husted's not a spring chicken, but he's much younger than Sherrod Brown is.
Right.
And then the question is always, do people like to vote for people who've lost?
Mm. Yeah. Well, it all comes down to turnout, and it is a mid-year election that tends to go badly for the party that just won the White House. So that's what Ohio Democrats are hoping. But this is a red state, so it's going to take a bit of a wave for Democrats to make any kind of inroads. We'd like to thank our panel, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter from Cleveland.com, Noah Blundo from Hannah News Service, and Susan Tebben from Ohio Capital Journal. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Happy New Year.
Happy holidays.
You too.
Study that millage. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mike Thompson.